Oh, hi there. This is M.P. Fitzgerald, author of A Happy Bureaucracy, and I'm pretending to play the jazz piano.
No one is holding a gun to my head to say this, but they are withholding the antidote. Funding for this podcast comes from ebook and paperback sales of A Happy Bureaucracy, the book. Send a warning to you straight-laced and prudish books on your bookcase by adding paperback copies of A Happy Bureaucracy, Fear and Loathing in the Wasteland, and post-apocalyptic pirates. Just head over to my website, mpfitzgerald.art. Once more, that's mpfitzgerald.art. Okay.
Just please spare my family. Please spare my family.
Fear and Loathing in the Wasteland. The Happy Bureaucracy, Book 2, by M.P. Fitzgerald, narrated by Gary Bennett. Author's note. Strewn between drug use, groin malice, and cursing on a level tantamount to sacrilege are even more gratuitous mentions of bureaucracy. These bureaucratic references may not be for the weak of heart. Also, child endangerment. Did I mention child endangerment? Chapter 11. Robbie's heart beat as intensely as a line of taiko drums. This could have been the cocaine. This could have been the fact that she had been up for hours with no sleep on said cocaine. Sure, and you know what? There was no way that the cocaine had nothing to do with it. But she knew the real answer. She was driving at night, and every ounce of her body screamed at the idea. A United Wastes caravan was one of the last remaining places where rules mattered. They were not as tightly organized as the IRS, but outside of the federal anomaly that she now worked for, caravans were likely the last places for whatever amounted to civility in the irradiated wasteland that America had become. Each caravan was a little different. Some were led by the dizzied minds of cult leaders, would-be shamans, prophets, and preachers. Others were just large family units, and still more were only loosely tied together by everyone's need for another. No matter what, though, all of the caravans followed three rules. Don't trade with slavers. You scavenge for yourself. And never drive at night. Only predators drove at night. If you risked it, you were the most noticeable thing on the road. Driving at night was painting a target on yourself. Guess this meant that Rabia was the predator tonight. Though the risk tonight was low, it still went against everything she was taught. With the IRS squaring off against Slaver City, everyone else was as far away as they could get. There was little chance that land pirates would pounce on her while she descended the mountain, but rationality was shit all against her wound-up nerves. Fear and loathing in the wasteland. There was nothing new here. The ghostly ash illuminated brightly under the electric glare of her headlights. Of course, the one time she decided to drive at night and the conditions made her twice as visible. This did nothing to soothe her nerves. By the time Robbie and Dinner had walked back to the shark, hours had passed, leaving Dinner drowsy and exhausted. Dinner needed no help falling asleep when she got into the mutant car, which was all for the better. Rabia did not want the little one to see just how frightened she was. If they were lucky, they would be at the bottom of the mountain just before daybreak. Bad omens and dark portents were all she saw once on the other side of the mountain. The tax army had advanced farther than she had hoped. She saw no lights and no signs of life at the base of the mountain. Slaver City, however, was lit up like a dried Christmas tree, and the tax army appeared to be at its front door. They must have been at each other's throats for the whole day. A whole day where Arthur could have been killed in battle or taken out by one of Boyd's assassins. Aside from the obvious consequences of the war having started, it also meant that Rabia would have to drive farther than she had planned. She was not sure if she would have the energy for it. She could push herself further with more cocaine, but it was a greedy habit with a fleeting high. Cocaine always disappeared faster than she had planned, and a salt shaker was always smaller than she thought. There were other drugs she could take, of course, but all of them had drawbacks. The LSD could keep her up, but in her state, the paranoia would surely destroy her. There were more uppers, but there was also a full day of war ahead of her. She would burn out sooner or later. Why make the end result worse? She would have to ease off of the powder and settle on her coffee rations. This was the last thing she wanted to do, an absolute last resort. A caffeine addiction was a terrible habit, after all. Dinner slept like an angel, which admittedly was a strange thing for a child to do after she had murdered somebody. It was undoubtedly not her first time. The shark weaved down the mountain easily. Even though she had descended this mountain twice before, nothing was familiar except for the horizon. It wasn't until she had descended it completely that she felt confident on the road. The dark of night was still complete, and the silence that helped shroud the landscape was only kept at bay by the whine of the shark's engine and Dinner's slight snore. Rabia's nerves were spent, her body ached, and her mind slowed. As she passed the twisted carcass of a motorcycle she had bombed so many days ago, she decided that she could put it off no longer. She needed coffee. The drug had worn off, and she felt her entire being had become sluggish. She gulped down the dark, muddy liquid from her thermos. It was instant coffee, and every bit of it tasted terrible. Holy mother shit buckets, she cursed after gulping down the hate-filled liquid. Dinner stirred and woke from the sudden outburst. She rubbed her eyes sleepily, then asked, Are we there yet? I want to see Arthur. Me too, Rabia thought to herself. Not yet, but we are close. The sun should be rising soon. We'll see him if he's still alive. Rabia was unscathed by the second attempt on her life, so the probability that Arthur was still alive was at least that good. Throughout their night drive, the possibility of an assassin seeing them teased her mind and worried her psyche. Yet they never came. Wherever the assassin was, they probably had not got to Arthur yet. Rabia took another pull off her wretched coffee and briefly had to convince herself that it was a better alternative to cocaine. Failing this, she knew at least that the last thing she would want to do was snort drugs in front of Dinner. The sun had not yet peeked out from the horizon, but the sky had grown lighter. No longer was it the haunting pitch black they had to endure and hunt under. Working hours for the IRS would begin at 8. She had at least until then before the war continued. Dinner was content to stare out ahead while Rabia drove. They only slowed once to drive around the slaughtered Volkswagen she had destroyed on her last trip here. Once they were past that, the IRS's camp drew closer. By the time she had lit, then finished a cigarette, and taken another swig of coffee, they were practically there. The camp had seen them. A searchlight mounted on top of a van shone on the shark, and a warning shot rang past them. Rabia stopped the car, tore down the tarp that had protected them from the ugly rain, and stood up on her seat. After removing her IRS badge, she waved it into the air and prayed to whatever slumbering ancient beast passed for a god that they wouldn't shoot. The searchlight cut out, and Rabia slowly sat back down. Somehow she had made it, her first night drive, and nothing went wrong. Somehow she knew that was the end of her luck. But what more could she do but go forward? Rabia eased the shark forward, careful not to make any sudden movements. There was still time for the other enforcers to decide that she was the enemy in disguise. Once she came close to the van that had spotted them, she turned off the engine and waited for an enforcer to approach.
Are we there yet? Can we go and see Arthur?
Dinner asked.
Yes, we're here. I just got to talk to these men first, and we can be on our way,
Rabia said as she drank more coffee, desperately trying to feel the energy it failed to provide to her. The enforcer that approached them looked down at Dinner with sad eyes, but said nothing. Rabia had only worked for the IRS for a full tax season and had not seen any other children but Dinner, yet the rest of the bunker reacted to her the same way as this enforcer. They reacted like they had all once been her.
No one radio about your arrival, miss. Please step out and state your business.
Rabia sighed, a noise that was mixed with exhaustion and annoyance. She took a parting sip from her coffee, then placed it on the dashboard.
You can't have any, Robbie said sternly to the child as she left the car. It was good to stretch her legs, and the morning chill against her skin was refreshing and helped to wake up her tired mind. She handed her badge over to the enforcer. I've got special intelligence, she said. Stopped a surprise attack to get it. Big intelligence. I need to talk to some top brass. The enforcer looked at the badge with surprised eyes, then met the bloodshot eyes of Rabia. She knew she looked like she had been through hell. There was no reason to doubt her. It's still off time for most of the camp, the enforcer said. Good luck finding an ear to hear you, but you're clear to come in. Rabia removed her shades from a pocket and placed them over her weathered and tired face. The light was still low, but they comforted her. She gave the other enforcer a half-assed salute, then walked back to the van to retrieve dinner. The enforcer marched back to his van, leaving her alone. She was surprised to find that the little girl was already out of the shark, the pistol she had given her in her hand. You won't need that here, Rabia said, her heart half-melting to see the young one so attached to the gun. It brought back warm memories of Robbie's own childhood. Rabia grabbed the coffee thermos and finished what was left in it, hoping that it would give her the boost she needed to find Arthur. Dinner watched her drink it with unwavering attention. Right, Rabia announced to the little one. We need to find Arthur and someone in operations to pass on our intelligence. As we are in the operations section of camp... Something was wrong. Rabia suddenly felt very tired. This in and of itself was not odd. She had been awake for more than 24 hours. But this was... familiar. Drunk, almost. Her mind went from sluggish to slothful, and she felt her aching muscles relax, feeling almost numb. It felt like one of her tranquilizers. Rabia felt her legs start to give, and her head felt almost dizzy. All of this would have been pleasant if it was planned. The... fuck? What the fuck? She muttered as she caught herself from falling by the hood of the shark. She had to force her own neck to lift her head up, and when she did, dinner was gone. The little demon must have drugged her coffee with the trank she was given, then ran off with the pistol. It hit her like a freight train on rocket boosters. Dinner kept asking about Arthur. The second assassin never hunted down Rabia, because she was seated next to her the entire time. Rabia didn't know how she was paid or why she would do it. All she knew was that she was starting to fade and succumbed to the drug. You Iscariot black-hearted brat, Rabia tried to shout, but was unable to get her tongue to make any consonants. If she passed out, this was it. Arthur was dead. Good thing she still had some cocaine. Her body did very little of what she demanded of it. She lacked both time and motor skills to do this well. She pushed herself up and off of the hood, then, with tremendous effort, fished out the salt shaker with numb hands and violently shook the cocaine out of the shaker and onto the hood of the car. An aggressive cloud of white powder spread against the cold steel of the car. She could feel herself fade. There was no time. Rabia fell face forward against the cloud and, with her last bit of effort, inhaled as deeply as she could. That did the trick. With a jolt of energy hitting her mind like a brick through a window, Rabia's senses flooded back. It was a strange high, one that would certainly put a strain on her heart, but these were desperate times. With the edge of her hands, she quickly tried to gather what was left of the powder and had another, more controlled go at it. Her vision in one eye seemed blurred. Her hands were still numb, and though her heart was beating like the wings of a hummingbird, her mind was in a fog. An upper never canceled out a depressant. The two always mixed into some unholy chimera. But she could walk now. She could hunt. The enforcer she had spoken to earlier came out of his van with hurried urgency, apparently having heard the ruckus she was making. What's happening? He asked as Rabia ran to the back of the shark and opened the trunk. Never mind that, she shouted under a mouth that still spoke in slurs. She grabbed the first weapon she came across, having no time to be picky. I'm a goddamn professional, she continued, holding the harpoon gun. As soon as the weapon touched her hands, Rabia ran toward the camp. The other enforcer slowly went back to his van. Good neighbor, Rabia thought. He knows to stay out of other people's business. Rabia kicked the ground and blindly set a course ahead, full speed.
This neighborhood is nothing but watch. A neighborhood watch, watching the neighborhood watch for neighbors.
Robbie's mind felt like it was sinking. The trank had gripped it in a thick mud, and the thoughts that had bubbled up to the surface were through a dirty lens. She relaxed, and besides the sheer bloody panic that kept her running forward, she almost felt euphoric. There was not going to be another pick-me-up. Rabia had emptied the cocaine.
Goddamn coffee, she thought. I knew I shouldn't drink coffee. Got to stick to the neighborly drugs, the patriotic ones.
She barreled forward. There was no sign of dinner. The child was small, had a head start, and the camp was too big and crowded with too many places to hide. Rabia was traveling blind. She had no idea where her target had gone, and no idea where her target was going. Hell, she didn't even know what she was going to do when she found the child. She didn't want to harm her, but her plan began and ended with two words: harpoon gun. It was a good plan. Robbie stopped to gather her thoughts, a process harder than she anticipated. At once, she stumbled over herself, finding her own momentum to be a force not easily ceased. She felt sort of drunk. No, belligerent. Her hands felt suddenly very warm, and Rabia became aware of the pulsing veins in her arms, each twitching as her heart raced to shake itself apart.
Get a hold of yourself, she thought, with every ounce of lucidity that was left in her. You're a good neighbor and a goddamn patriot. This town was made for you, and what the fuck is this neighbor shit?
She shook her head, hoping that she could right herself with emotion. Her hands felt hot. She could feel the beating of her heart in her ears. Half of her vision was still blurred.
You got this.
Deductive reasoning. Out to lunch. Rational thinking. Soliciting a party clown for sex. Ability to run and yell. Fully functional.
The British are coming!
Rabia screamed as she ran in the direction her head was pointed in. Her voice echoed back to her in angry chops. The weight of the harpoon gun suddenly felt immense, and she almost dropped it. Heads peeked out of the side doors of vans and through cracks in tents. She scrambled to keep the gun in her hands as her running became controlled stumbling. And to think, just an hour ago she was worried about dinner's safety. Now she could barely keep a device used to murder whales in her hands long enough to use it on her.
There goes the neighborhood, her mind offered.
The fatal flaw in her current strategy became clear once she got a grip on her weapon and her running, but hardly on herself.
Yelling gives me away.
One of the heads peeking out of a tent, a studious one likely belonging to an auditor, spoke to her.
Who is coming?
He asked, and jumped in a startle as Rabia did the same.
Shh!
Rabia hissed at him. The head disappeared back into the tent. Rabia marched on. A lucid part of her knew that this was a doomed effort. She could not think clearly and increasingly did not understand her own motives. Was she trying to save Arthur or kill dinner? Why were they the same? And why would she want to do harm to the precious child that drew such a beautiful picture of them together? Hadn't she wanted to display that crayon hemorrhage on the wall of her bunker? Hadn't she wanted Arthur to see it? None of it made sense, but her feet kept moving. She only took solace in that finding Arthur was probably as hard for dinner as it was for her. At least a tranked-up woman was on an even playing field as a child. She dropped the harpoon gun. Her feet tried to be in the same place. She fell down hard on her hands and felt only the wetness of blood, but not pain. Then she vomited. Whether through instinct or experience, or both, Rabia pushed herself to the side, away from the vomit, so that she would not drown in it. Then there was nothing.
About the author. M.P. Fitzgerald is an author and humorist dedicated to injecting the feverish gonzo style into fiction. You can get Memos from the Wasteland, which is the official prequel to this book, free. It contains hilariously bleak office drama, Robbie's diary, and Arthur's last letter from his father. To get your copy, just head over to his website at mpfitzgerald.art. You'll also get free updates on future audiobooks and more. We hope you have enjoyed A Happy Bureaucracy by M.P. Fitzgerald. Narrated by Gary Bennett. Text copyright 2019 by M.P. Fitzgerald. Production copyright 2021 by M.P. Fitzgerald.
Music by Dustmice. Available on all streaming services. And Dustmice.bandcamp.com.